So once people start using our product, they give it to their teammates, they give it to their clients, even resell the product. Hey, I'm going to manage your Potion account for you, and I'll sell this managed service for X dollars. And then they, so they're building businesses on top of our product, which is pretty cool to see. So 50% of our business comes from that channel, which was not expected, honestly. Yeah.
How do you do the integrations? Like, what kind of marketing tools do you integrate with now, or how does someone get started on the platform?
There's two kinds of integrations. One that brings customer data into Potion, so you can create videos for these leads and prospects. So we have CRM integrations with HubSpot, Salesloft, Salesforce.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Ignite podcast. Today we're delighted to have Kanad Bahalkar on the program. He's the founder of Potion. He's ex-Google, ex-Endurance. He's living in the Bay Area, California. Kanad, welcome to the program. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's super fun. The first time we had a conversation, like, I loved your energy as well. So I was like, yes, I get to chat with Brian for a whole hour. So really excited to be here, and I'm all yours for the next hour.
You know what's funny about podcasts is I think it enforces me to be super present with the person for a whole hour. And you just don't get that in modern society that often, where you just have this like very intent conversation where you're listening and really engaging. And I think a podcast kind of enforces that.
Yes, that is absolutely true. Notice this more and more. Like, I run a podcast for my company Potion as well. Mm. And if I'm outside hanging out with my friends or just like at a networking event or something like that, I'm like half listening.
Yeah.
Because I'm already exhausted. But like when I'm on a podcast, I'm like, okay, I have to listen to you because I have to hold the conversation with you. So it's almost like meditation in some ways.
And I find it's funny because, you know, I think anyone who's been listening to this podcast for a while has heard the story. Can't talk today. It's Monday here. Monday morning recording is, you know, like everyone I've had on the podcast, I just build a better relationship with. And so it made sense. You know, I went on a podcast, had a really good experience with somebody in my network, a founder who also had a podcast. And I was like, wait, I have over 100 portfolio companies now for Team Ignite. I should start interviewing them and helping them get notoriety and PR and just, you know, it just helps you as a member of Team Ignite eventually. Yeah, it just makes a lot of sense. But anyway, we'd love to get an intro from you for the audience, who you are and where you're coming from.
Sure, absolutely. So I'm Kanad. I grew up in India. My father worked for the government. We don't really come from like an entrepreneurial type background, definitely not like a tech background. And moved around quite a bit in my early days because my father got transferred to different locations in his career. Somehow got into computer science, actually. So one of my best friends growing up, he was obsessed with computers. And he showed me this movie, Pirates of Silicon Valley. And it's based on a true story of the Steve Jobs and Bill Gates rivalry back in the day. And that movie left a pretty big impact on me. I didn't have a computer until I was like 16, 17, something like that. So after that, I watched the movie. I realized what can be done with this, and this lights just clicked. So that's how I got into like computer science.
What's the name of the movie?
Pirates of Silicon Valley.
Pirates of Silicon Valley. I don't know if I've seen it.
It's one of my favorite movies of all time. It's ridiculously good.
Adding it to my watch list as we speak. That's interesting. Yeah, I need to watch this.
Yeah, there's a scene in the movie where Bill Gates, Paul Allen, and I forget, Steve Ballmer are striking a deal with IBM, like a $100 million deal. And they pitch IBM, hey, we will sell you the software that's needed to run these machines because you're moving in the personal computing business now. So they made the deal. And then on their way out, Bill Gates told Paul Allen to drive him to a company called Seattle Computers or Seattle Computer Systems and bought the operating system. They had nothing when they made the deal. Then they bought this OS for like 50 grand from this guy in a basement, and he was really perplexed, like, why would you want to buy my software? But they built their whole business on just sales skills, and that was run by a tech guy, which was really impressive to me.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people don't know is how ruthless Bill Gates was as a businessman.
Yeah,
he was just cutthroat, and his dad was a businessman, right? So it made sense because his dad was there a long way advising him on all matters of business, and he kind of grew up in an entrepreneurial kind of business family. Yeah, and some of those deals were just ingenious deals. It wasn't so much the tech that won there; it was very much the first off, IBM giving away the software. Oh yeah, go ahead and do the software and we'll license that from you. That's low margin. Nobody cares about that. You know, we'll sell the hardware. We own the system.
Yeah.
That was the first master stroke, right? And then the second, that was actually the second. I think the first was buying DOS for like a pittance, right?
Yeah, they bought DOS from Seattle Computing.
Yeah, yeah. Turned around and sold it to IBM for $100 million.
Yep. Or I don't know if it was exactly $100 million, but it was. Right. That basically said that basically made their company.
I love that. I love that story. So that must have put kind of a chip on your shoulder moving around a lot as a kid. I did that a lot as a kid as well. Like two elementary schools, two middle schools, two high schools. And so I constantly had to make new friends, and it was a real challenge for me.
Yep. Something similar happened to me as well. We kept moving. We didn't move 10, 12 times, but we did move like 3 or 4 times. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, you do get this sense of, okay, I need to fit in this new environment. You don't think of it consciously, but that's just how you get shaped. And now that I'm looking back at it, I'm realizing, okay, I started picking up different languages. I started picking up different ways of like talking to people just because
adopt different kind of cultural stances on things. Mm-hmm. Like I remember I went from, I kind of changed my identity at each school a little bit. Yes. I was like, okay, I'm going to reinvent myself a little bit. I didn't do it consciously.
Yeah.
It just sort of like emerged from the experience. And that was really fascinating in hindsight.
Absolutely. In college, we have a concept called junior college. It's like after 10th grade, you spend a couple of years figuring out what you do. So I had my science branch junior college. And that's where I intentionally started molding my identity go in a certain direction. I was really curious about physics and stuff like that. So up till that point, I was completely unaware of how the environment was shaping my identity. And you do start picking up like cultural cues just so you fit in, which is a really interesting thing that you just don't notice. It's
right. Weird. So tell us about that path. So it was literally this movie that kind of opened your eyes to tech, and you're like, okay, I'm going to go study. In India, as I understand, you have to study really hard to get into a good school. You have to take this exam.
Actually, like for me, it wasn't that hard. I don't.
Humble brag, not that hard.
Like, it wasn't that. The exams I took were not the most daunting ones. I actually wanted to do astrophysics after my junior college. But my dad wanted me to be an engineer, so he put me in engineering school. And
what
I went
kind of engineer did he want you to be?
I don't think he cared.
As long as it had engineer in the title and in the program. Yeah.
So he grew up with somewhat of a financial insecurity. So growing up, like he probably made like $2,000 a year. So we didn't really grow up with like a lot of money. So he, in the back of his mind, he was like, hey, with physics, you might become a professor somewhere, teach kids. You're not going to make too much money. You're going to lead the same life that I led. Mm-hmm. So I want you to be an engineer so you can have financial security going forward. So I think that was his like main driver. So I went to like a local engineering college in my city, and really small college. And that was like the first push for me to like do something about like computer science and this and that. Also started doing like mini projects on the side, which was really fun. We didn't have like an internet thing on my computer, so I had to learn coding in books, was very interesting. But yeah, it was very rewarding looking back. That builds a certain resourcefulness. Like, hey, if you don't have the internet, go out and like, find answers.
Yeah, figure it out.
Yeah, you figure it out. Yeah, even if it taught me how to be resourceful.
I love that. And then so walk us through kind of, from college to Persistent and then Google.
So after college, in India, there is a strange, like a recruiting process where these big companies like Persistent, Infosys come to your college and then they do like fresher type interviews. And through that, I got selected to Persistent Systems, which was one of the biggest companies in, at least at the time, in my city. And I worked there for about a year and a half as an engineer. I knew I wanted to start my own business back then. I wasn't crazy about money, but I wanted to build something really cool that that actually, like, I would have fun doing. So bought a one-way ticket to Boston and went to Northeastern, did my master's, and my parents played a big role.
So you got into Northeastern, you applied, and they're like, yeah, come on. Yeah, we'll take your 50 grand for your master's or whatever it is.
Correct.
And...
yeah. So yeah, give us 50k. We'll give
you finance that, like, as a foreign student. You just get like loans. They just like here's the loans and you can come do it.
This was actually quite tough because we didn't have like that kind of money. So my parents had to mortgage their home or remortgage, put their home as collateral for my student loan.
Wow. And, really?
Yeah. It was
in India. So India has loan programs for Indian students going to the States.
Correct. Yeah. So you get student loans from almost all the banks, but you have to put some assets as collateral should the student doesn't return the loan.
Wow.
Because there's no real credit system, or at least there wasn't any credit system back.
It's not how it works in the US at all. Like, like your parent might co-sign for it. And it's really hard to get a discharge in bankruptcy or whatever, but you never have to put your house up for collateral. That's crazy.
Yeah. But it all boils down to your credit score here. But back in India, you still need like a tangible asset. Sometimes people put gold, sometimes people put other assets.
But once you're here and you establish residency, can't you just get like regular grad school loans here? Or as a foreign student, you can't even do that?
I don't think that was an option for me, actually. But I knew I had to pay back like the loan. I worked extra hard.
Yeah. Well, yeah, your parents have basically bet the farm on you, so to speak, right? And so, like, you don't want to let them down. That's a lot of pressure.
Mm-hmm. After the after my master's was done, I worked at a company, Endurance, for about 3 years until I paid back my student loans and saved every penny I could and paid it back. And then I was like, okay, cool. I don't have the burden anymore. Now I can actually go out and learn things that I really came here to do. So I moved to San Francisco and joined an early stage startup called Knit Health. And David Jancis was running the startup then, and really, really fun project. We built a camera that could detect sleeping and breathing disorders in kids who have those disorders.
Oh, wow.
Like sleep apnea and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It was very, very cool. Eventually that startup got acquired by Google. Then I worked at Google as an engineer for about 3 or so years. I really thought Google would be a fun place to work, but it wasn't. It was really slow for my taste.
It's so funny you mention that, because anytime I talk to somebody, I worked at two big companies, Amazon and Microsoft. Anytime I talk, Amazon's very fast moving. A big startup. But anytime I talk to somebody at Microsoft, it feels like the clock speed's like 50% slower. Yeah. I'm just like, gosh, can you just spit it out already? Like, they just kind of talk and talk and talk and talk. And like, can you just get to the point? Like, it's almost as if they're trying to fill up the 30-minute meeting with as slow a talking as possible.
It's like really weird. Like, bigger companies, the more layers of management you have, the more pressure they feel to prove their worth.
It's all bureaucracy and posturing and politics. And that's why I got like, Microsoft's an amazing company. I'm not going to speak ill of it. I was there for 4 years, and there are great people there doing great work, but there are pockets of bureaucracy that just like turn into this, the inertia of just, it's like quicksand.
Yep. It's a death by slideshow. Death by PowerPoint, I guess. It's Microsoft. Totally. But I mean, Microsoft is actually a really good company. I believe it's, especially after Satya took on, there are some cultural shifts that are happening. They're going back to the roots, or like developer focus.
It used to be a really challenging place to work, I guess, 20 years ago.
People
were yelling at each other and getting into fist fights and stuff.
Yep. Before Google, Microsoft was the place to be. It was like Google and Microsoft were like the top places you could work for when I was growing up. I was like dream companies. But Google has become really slow in almost anything. I don't know how they can solve this problem. They've been really fast with like Bard and adopting the LLM wave pretty quickly.
Yeah, I was just watching their Google Next and their you know, 2-hour keynote with all the demos. And I was like, okay, they're building stuff. I mean, they're trying.
So they do have the potential.
Yeah.
And honestly, like some of the people I worked with at Google were the most competent people, especially on the engineering side that I've ever worked with. Like really, really smart people. But yeah, it's a team effort at the end of the day. So we can talk about how Google is bad all day long.
No, that could take up an hour for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, so moved to San Francisco. That startup got acquired by Google, but I didn't come to this country to be an employee. So quit Google to start Potion about 3 years ago. And we ended up building one of the first, if not the first, generative video AI platform. And it was, well, it still is, but I'm still running it. It's one of the coolest projects I've ever worked on. When we started building this, almost all the investors I pitched to just didn't believe that generative AI would be a thing.
Well, that's 3 years ago, right? Like, so yeah, it wasn't like, really a thing. Yeah. No,
I mean, there were like a handful of like Ulas from Streamline Ventures. Like, even he did like their diligence on, okay, you're building this AI thing. Good, cool. What's the real application? Do you have real customers? So they talk to our customers to make sure that we're not just building the cool stuff just for the sake of it, but there's a business here. But he was one of the few folks that believed that, okay, this is where the wave is going. Unshackled, who was our first check-in, Nathan and Manan, both of them, they essentially just took a bet on me. We didn't have a product back then. We didn't have anything. There was like, you seem like a good person. You seem like you can build stuff. Let's see what happens.
Yeah. I mean, anyone who's leaving the cocoon of Google to start a startup, usually it's a pretty decent bet right there, you know, just that alone. Because like you could just work at Google and make, you know, like very great salary and just kind of punch the clock and, you know, I don't know, get breakfast, lunch, and dinner served to you. And just relax, you know, just be kind of semi-retired, basically.
Yeah. That's the only thing I miss. The food was really good.
Well, that's my one of my classmates will love to hear that he heads up their food design.
Yeah, one of my friends is a chef. I don't think he still works there, but he invited me to like his thing. And usually it's like a cafeteria style food, so it's like almost like a buffet. But his kitchen was like a specialty kitchen, and like it was like one of the best meals experiences I've ever had. And I was like, God damn, Dave, you should start like a Michelin level restaurant or something.
Yeah,
like
that. Yeah. So what was that genesis like? So you're sitting at Google, and then what was the aha moment like? You're like, okay, this is worth pursuing and potentially leaving the company.
Early on, I was testing a bunch of different ideas to see what sticks. I was sending folks emails on like, hey, I'm thinking of doing this. What about XYZ? Do you have this problem? Blah. So typical like sales type emails.
Yeah, you're doing customer discovery. Yeah.
Yeah, simple customer.
Hey, if I solve this problem, would you pay X dollars for it or whatever?
Yeah, stuff like that. So I didn't have a product back then, but I needed to see what problems were there in order to build a product. And I realized I was actually creating like Loom videos for folks going on their website and like, hey, John, I was on your website. Looks like you have this. Your traffic is XYZ. What are some of the pinch points in your funnel? Let's talk about that. Do you have 15 minutes to jump on a call? That type of messaging. And I realized that if you send these personalized Loom videos to folks, they are way more likely to engage with you and do like a discovery call.
So you learned this just in your own sales kind of customer discovery outreach, that these personalized videos were garnering a much higher percentage of
significantly higher. Nobody would even respond to text emails anymore. Like as long, typically people think that text-based emails are just like a robot type email.
Yeah.
But they ignore it unless they know you as a personal, through a personal branding experience. But
usually I reference our mutual connections. I put a little link in there. I say, hey, we have a lot of mutual connections. I literally run the search on LinkedIn and I say, here's the link to our mutual connections. That works really well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What's the, like, what do you say before and after that?
Just, you know, whatever the pitch is. Hey, we should talk. I'm a investor, blah, blah, blah. But like, look at our mutual connections. And then they could go look and they're like, oh, okay, yeah, we have like 30 mutual connections. So I don't want to like blow you off.
Okay. Yeah.
So that works really well. The social proof. Anyway.
Okay. I'm going to steal this idea. Let's see if it yields well for us. But the thing that I learned is if you can send videos that are personalized to them, they engage with you. Okay, cool. So I started recording all these videos. It's impossible to like record more than a handful of videos every day. Yeah. So cool. There was this AI thing that I worked on at Nitel, Google as well. What can I do to build a tool that automates this process? Because this is not a traditional engineering type automation. You need to synthesize content. So we started building Potion. That was the germination of the idea.
Very cool. And kind of walk us through the first, like, are you a solo founder? Who's on the team? And what was that kind of getting that first paid customer like?
It was just me when I started. Now we have 11 people. And the first customer actually came through a webinar that I didn't run. This was very serendipitous, actually. We were just doing research early on. We were not really specifically doing the sales part. We wanted to understand, like, is this even possible? And we built, like, an MVP. And then one of the early users also had a sales channel on YouTube. So I messaged him, like, hey, can we do, like, a co-marketing thing together? And he was like, cool, let's do that. And in exchange, I gave him UX facelift to his app. So I was like, hey, I'll design this UX for you. Let's run a webinar together. So he did the webinar and we got our first customer through that. And he was paying $100 per month. I think he's still our customer, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he's a real estate guy. So we tested with, okay, can the real estate agents use this? Doesn't look like, besides this guy, not many real estate agents want to use it. And we decided to pivot a couple times on the target market and landed on the SDR, BDR. Type folks who actually use the product frequently. And to date, our customers have generated over 6.2 million videos using our AI.
That's amazing. Over 6 million videos.
Yeah. Every week we're adding like 100K new videos.
Wow. That's a ton. So what's the, you know, as you think about, you know, generating these, when you first started, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, you're probably using some off the shelf model. We're using a closed source, open source model. Like what was that initial tech look like? And how has that progressed over the years?
Like the very first application didn't have any AI. We were just cutting, pasting different videos, stringing them together. It looked very janky because like when you cut different videos, it just looks weird. The hey, Brian, and then cut to a different video completely. So we just wanted to test if people would actually use this approach or not. Turns out they did, but their biggest complaint was, hey, the cut is too visible. What can we do? And then we started experimenting with AI models. The first one, like Deepfix was, it's not new. So we started using like off-the-shelf Deepfake tools to see if we can do this. The problems there were very evident. Like you have to train the models on like tons and tons of data to maintain like each one model for each customer and just
right.
too much. Yeah. So we decided like building tools to actually, that was the real research that Marcus, our head of AI leads even today and figured out over the last 3 years, how we can synthesize videos at scale with high accuracy and at a very low cost. So we can actually mass produce videos. So you're not going to spend $1 an email if you're sending an email campaign.
It's too much.
You need unit economics like that to actually make this work at scale for any company. So that's the thing we worked very much on in the last few years. So
really, the part of the secret sauce, secret ingredient in Potion is this sort of you've been able to radically reduce the inference costs of generating these videos.
Yes, yeah.
Because initially with off-the-shelf technologies, it sounded like it was $1 to inference and generate these videos, and that wasn't going to scale. If you're sending dozens of emails a day, you know, hundreds of emails a day, LinkedIn messages, whatever, you can't afford to pay that. It's just like becomes a non-starter. So how many orders of magnitude you've gotten it down to cents, I assume, at this point?
Our inference and storage cost is right now 4 cents. By the end of this year, I'm fairly confident I can push it down to a cent or less per video.
That's crazy. And that's how fast AI is moving, and people don't realize it, is that, you know, when you get a talented team from Google and elsewhere, really looking at a problem that business users have and solving that problem, you can take things from $1 to 10 cents to a penny. right? Very quickly, within a year or two. And a lot of times when I, as an investor, when I'm looking at business plans, I'm not really, I don't really, you know, it sounds really funny, as somebody who's worked in AI for over a decade, I actually don't care about the tech as much, because the technological moats aren't as important as they were 10 or 20 years ago. I really, really care about the problem and the team. Because I know the tech, like if you worked at Google, you're talented enough to go figure out the tech. And I also know that, like, when I'm looking at like inferencing costs, so like right now we're charging $100 a month and it's costing us $100 a month to inference. I'm like, great, that's fine. Because I know over time it's going to get 10x and then 100x better.
Yeah.
So just an incredible time to be alive. And like, that's why I'm super bullish on the application layer. It's really, really, really hard to compete down there at the foundational model layer, the open source model layer, the framework layer. Like, that's just really hard. And it's so hard. We know their names, right? It's Anthropic, it's Perplexity, it's, you know, it's Google and OpenAI, Microsoft. We know who's competing there, and it's really difficult. But not a lot of people know who Potion is, but yet here's Potion solving a business problem, very high margins, scaling very quickly in the application layer, which is fascinating.
Yep. So one of the things that if you want to talk about like high margin, so right now we sell our product at $100 per month for like 750 video generations.
750 per month. Awesome. Yep.
Yeah. And we still make profit on that. Like there's gross profit on that.
It's kind of like I use Opus for my clips and Riverside. Yeah. Like there's a certain amount of credits you get, right? 750, and then there's overage. So if I want to do what's the overage look like? What do you charge for the deck?
We don't charge any overage, actually. So we just we have an upgrade path once we exhaust your limits. One of the things we haven't cracked up till now is the pricing structures. So there are a few things we need to test, like free trials, paid trials. There are
I get 5 free videos a month or 10 free videos a month or something that.
So we don't do any marketing either. There are no PLG loops. We just don't have enough time to actually build this quickly. Mm. So overage charges, term mix, plan mix, that we haven't tested any of that just yet. Add-on strategy is not built out either. What we want to test right now is, are people going to buy this? Who is the right buyer? What is the right messaging? And then we can figure out the rest of the stuff as we scale.
Yeah.
So that we have early signals of product market fit. Right now, we're in the midst of getting the product market channel mix. And once that's done, then we can start experimenting with pricing strategies, because these are the fundamentals that we need to get right before we start investing more time in what is the right messaging look like, what is the right pricing. But hey, is anybody going to use the product? Are they driving business like for themselves using the product? Those are the answers I need first before I go in that direction.
Yeah. And we do a ton of MarTech at Team Ignite. Shout out to Team Ignite. Lots of folks there. I mean, I come from a MarTech ad tech background. Yeah. And so we tend to invest in a lot of companies like that. And we have lots of partners and resources and LPs and mentors in that area. So all my alarm bells are going off with people that can help in the pricing, packaging stuff. And then also I have alarm bells going off, or light bulbs going off, that are advising startups that would be potential clients to yours. So how are you guys going out and acquiring customers right now? Are you just basically dogfooding your own product and saying, hey, by the way, this video was created with the AI that that you could also be using? Is it more or less that kind of message?
Yep, actually, yes. That's literally one of the campaigns that we're running right now. So 20% of our customers come through this outbound campaign where we use our own tool to reach out to folks.
Yeah.
30% comes from organic search, and 50%, which is really surprising, comes from referrals. So once people start using our product, they give it to their teammates, they give it to their clients, even resell the product. Hey, I'm going to manage your Potion account for you, and I'll sell this managed service for X dollars. And then they're building businesses on top of our product, which is pretty cool to see. So 50% of our business comes from that channel, which was not expected, honestly. Yeah.
How do you do the integrations? Like, what kind of marketing tools do you integrate with now, or how does someone get started on the platform?
There's two kinds of integrations. The one that brings customer data into Potion, so you can create videos for these leads and prospects. So we have CRM integrations with HubSpot, Salesloft, Salesforce.
The big ones. CRM. Yep.
I think we support like 50 integrations.
So I'm sending an email to Kanad, and I want him to buy my product. There's like this little integration where I can insert the video.
Correct.
And then is it a link or attachment? A hosted link somewhere?
There is no attachment. We don't do attachments. It gives you a snippet, like an HTML code that has a GIF preview and a link in it. And the GIF preview and the link changes depending on who you're sending this video to. So just like when you send email campaigns, it's like, hey, curly brace first name, and the curly brace first name changes depending on the name of the person. We do the exact same thing, but for video and link that you add in your email body. So you don't have to copy paste each video one by one. If you're sending a campaign to 10,000 people, you can't do that. So we automated that process as well.
And then how do you change the messaging for each individual prospect? Is it, you know, hi, first name, and then is it the same after that? Or is it, I record a video, obviously.
Yeah, you
know, yes. Walk us through the steps of onboarding. Like, hey, I'm super interested in this. Like, how do I get started?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are three facets to onboarding and like being successful with Potion. The first one is the video recording. Second one is the integration part, which we just spoke about.
Yeah.
The third one is branding, like branding the videos and video pages with your own brand. So as a new user, you go on the platform, you record a video template using your front camera. You don't need like a special setup, no lighting, 3-point lighting, stuff like that. Just your webcam is good. You record a video template, just like how you type an email template for your email copy. You do like, hey, John, or like, hey there, this is kinda blah, blah, blah. Insert my sales pitch here. I was just on your website, etc. Once you record the template, the AI knows where the first name of the person is going to be. So it just automatically does it for you. And you can also declare and show what's going to go in the picture-in-picture background. So, you know, like in a Loom video, the picture-in-picture videos, you have a bubble at the bottom left and there's a background screen. With that background itself is also like personalized. So it picks up the website or the landing page of the people that you're sending this video to.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah.
So you're you're looking at the website of the prospect.
Correct. Yeah.
Interesting.
So it creates a picture-in-picture video with the prospect's website and the prospect's name, what have you, with accurate lip sync and what have you. So it creates this experience that is tailored for each and every recipient. And so what you have a video template. What do you do with it? You now add this video template to your outreach sequence in your email. Mm-hmm. So we have integrations with all these tools like HubSpot, Instantly, copy the snippet, paste it inside your email template, you're done. The third piece is actually customizing the experience on the video page. So we help them add custom domains, add their color, logo, branding, everything. So if you go on a Loom video, you see like loom.com/blah, blah, blah. It's the Loom experience. It's not your company experience. We do that for our customers as well. So the whole micro landing page is branded with your own company branding elements, and that just makes like a seamless experience for your end prospects to consume and watch your video and then engage with you.
Wow. Amazing. What's your, you know, like kind of looking forward in the looking glass, like what do you see, where do you see Potion in 5 or 10 years?
Right now we have this really cool sales and marketing application for personalized videos, which in itself is actually a really big market. And it's 2.5 million non-retail sales folks in North America. And we're going to keep on approaching that, but that's one single application.
Yeah.
You mentioned early on that, hey, you have a platform, you have like a platform application of AI. What you want to be is the platform itself, not an add-on on the platform. Right now, we're an add-on on the platform. That's the first wedge that we have in the market. We are constantly getting requests for adjacent use cases, like, hey, I want to send personalized videos when somebody signs up on my newsletter. I want to create hyper-personalized tutorials for all my new users. I want to create, turn English videos into Spanish with accurate lip sync because my company is expanding to LATAM. So those types of requests we're already getting.
Yeah.
So what can we do to be the platform and service these requests over time? We're releasing our API. So people can build their own applications on top of our AI. And because we've cracked the scale part of this equation, it's really easy for us to let people use it and come up with their own applications without restricting them on the pricing. Some businesses require high pricing, some businesses require low pricing, but it's not possible for you to use, for example, Twilio API if each API request costed you $3.
Right.
Yeah. So that's unit economics at scale. Cracking that is really difficult, which we've done. Now we want to democratize this. So that's the next step we want to take on the product perspective. See where developers adopt this. See where businesses can get more traction, where they draw value the most, and then double down in that direction. So that's where we're going in the medium term. In the long term, I believe every single business is going to use synthetic video, synthetic audio in some capacity. Like, that's just going to happen. Right. You can't deny that.
Yep.
So what can we do as a company to help businesses create good content, update existing content, and protect against malicious actors? So as this technology becomes more commonplace, you're going to see bad actors creating bad content with malicious intent. So how do we identify that content? How do we identify the actors? How do we prevent spreading of this content? And how can we eliminate this content? So those types of solutions we'll build, like, for example, identity management, voice fingerprinting. That's where we're going in the next. So it's going to spawn newer industries. Like, synthetic media is going to spawn newer industries, not just like new markets. That's where we go in the next 5 years.
And in ways we can't even imagine, really, right?
I can.
Because we have a bunch of synthetic agents all talking to each other, right?
Yes, It's going to be fun, but I can clearly see how this might impact the world in a good and a bad way.
Yeah.
So you have to be in a position that amplify the goods and de-amplify the bads.
Yep. Yeah, that makes sense. Where can folks listening find out more about this platform?
Folks listening in, if you're interested in learning more, talking to us, or using the product, you can go on sendpotion.com. That's sendpotion.com. If you have any questions, you can also email me at kanad@sendpotion.com, which is kanad@sendpotion.com. So yeah, if anybody drops a message and says Brian's name in it, I'll put that on a high priority list.
Thanks. Well, why don't we wrap up with some quick rapid fire questions?
Yes, sir.
What is the first programming language you learned?
C.
Just C, C#, C++.
Just C, a good old C.
Just C. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Then my second one was CPP, C++.
Yeah. What's one tech tool you can't live without?
Tech tool? I mean, my phone. So unless you mean software.
Yeah. It's interesting. Our phones are really an extension of ourselves these days, right?
Like
if you don't have your phone on, you're like, okay, where's my phone? Stop everything. I don't care if I'm late to anything. I need to find my phone. Yeah. That's so, honestly, so interesting, right?
Like, I want to build something like that, like a product that you cannot live without. You can live without your phone, but still, it feels like you can't.
Not really. Yeah, I can't really. Not anymore. What's your favorite book or podcast on tech?
Favorite book is The Hard Thing About Hard Things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the best books I've ever read.
I haven't read it in 10 years. I need to reread that one. That was really good.
Oh, if you want to revisit that book, listen to the audiobook.
I did listen to the audiobook, actually, initially. Yeah. Did he narrate it himself?
That's the fun part. So every chapter starts with a rap verse.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't narrate the rap verse. He probably got like a rap artist to actually narrate the rap verse. And it's like starts each chapter with like a banger. and then...
I love that, how, because I'm a hip hop dude too. I grew up in the 90s, like with 90s hip hop and stuff. And so like for him to like just bring that hip hop culture into startups, like for me, it was like music to my ears.
Yep.
No pun intended. Who is the most influential person in your tech journey?
Most influential. So I actually consider influence in two ways, a direct influence and indirect influence. Direct influence, I think the biggest influence I've had was one of my very first bosses, Kurt Raffi. He was a GM. I worked directly under him at this company called Endurance. And he had this like energy about him that really inspired me. Big shout out to Kurt. So he had a direct influence on how I operated and thought about the world, because before I met him, I was very terse. I was extremely blunt on like how I actually felt about things. And I understood where to filter myself, where not to filter myself through watching him operate. Indirect influence, probably like almost every other tech person, Steve Jobs and Elon Musk, you read documentaries, you read their biographies and stuff like that. And
Isaacson biographies of both of those men are just amazing. Yeah.
So I haven't read Isaacson's on Elon Musk, but I read
Elon Musk's older
biography. That's one of the books that is on my list. And obviously Bill Gates, because Pirates of Silicon Valley was one of the biggest influential pieces of art in my life that pushed me in the direction that I want to go in.
Yeah. What's one habit that boosts your productivity?
Zero inbox.
Yeah, me too. I'm zero inbox as well.
Yeah. No other.
I have to get it out of my inbox.
Yeah. So I actually have three mega hacks. I don't know if you're ready. Are you ready?
Yeah.
The first one is zero inbox, which we already know about.
Yep.
And you don't need superhuman, although you should get superhuman if you don't have it. You can.
What's so good about superhuman? Like, I just use Gmail shortcuts and I'm good.
Yeah,
like,
same. I also use Gmail and archive all the emails that I'm done. I treat each email as a to-do. And if I'm done with responding to that, or if I finish the task, I just archive it. And my inbox is, well, I have six emails now since we've been speaking, but apart from that, my inbox is clean. So that's the first.
I started using labels for the first time in my life. I'll label things and get it out of my inbox. I'm like, I'm waiting for the founder on this one. Okay, label it waiting on the founder and just get it out of my inbox. Like, hey, I'm waiting for an analyst to work on this. Okay, I'll label it pending an analyst to get it out of my inbox. Yep. And then next time I'm talking to one of my analysts, I'll be like, hey, I have these three startups waiting for due diligence. Can you dig into one of these? And so like I've been, I'm the same. Like, it's like, I have to get it out of my inbox. If it's it's like, do now, do later, delegate, dump. Those are the four buckets.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. Yep. I also use labels quite heavily as well. So that's the first hack. Second hack is zero notifications.
Me too. Only text messages and WhatsApp.
Yep. So, and
that's it. Everything else is zero.
Yep. And when you get it, you consume that. And if it's useful, then okay. If it's not useful, then you suppress that notification. That's how you like draw down notifications. Yep. The third one is black and white. You can make your phone black and white. And it reduced my screen time dramatically, which is actually pretty big.
Because you're not tempted to just kind of start watching random stuff or browsing the internet and random things. And
it happens almost immediately when you turn it black and white. Content
just becomes much more of a text-based kind of a device.
Yes, and like when you are, let's say you're on LinkedIn or Instagram, like when you're scrolling, it's designed for you to keep on scrolling. But when you make it black and white, it becomes boring.
That's really interesting.
So you're like, oh, cool, I get it now. Then you turn it off. And the second big advantage is the notification bubble itself becomes black and white. Your brain is trained to click on that red dot as soon as you see it.
Yeah.
But you don't have to. If it's
black. You're talking about on iOS, they have the little next to the icons. Yeah, yes. I hate that.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't have that on we don't have that on Android.
Okay, cool. Maybe like there's a way to turn those off, but you don't wanna, in some cases, like you wanna see the text messages when they're received, but you're not tempted to immediately click on it. So those are like the three big hacks for productivity that I do.
I learned something there. What's your favorite leisure activity to unwind?
Two things, actually. One is riding my motorcycle and a pickleball. Like, I play a lot of pickleball.
Oh, that's funny. I'm playing pickleball for the first time tomorrow morning. My wife signed us up for lessons. I grew up in Seattle, so I grew up playing pickleball in like PE class.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're signed up for lessons, so it's going to be a thing, I guess, for us. Nice. But tell me about your motorcycle.
I have a Kawasaki Ninja, and it's really fun to ride. It's not heavy bike. It's a city bike.
Is it a little 400cc? Or?
Yes, yeah, it's a 400, yeah. It's like the smallest model you get.
Yeah.
So I don't.
It's still pretty powerful. Even a 400, it's like has a lot of speed.
Yeah, I grew up with like 150cc a model, so this one is definitely like thrice.
All right. Well, make sure you wear lots of protective gear. We need you alive. potion. I had an R6 back in the day. It's 20 years ago now.
Nice.
The thing was badass. My dad made me a deal. He was a smoker.
Yeah.
And he made me a deal that if I got rid of the bike, he'd quit smoking. And so he quit smoking, and I'm like, did you really quit smoking? He's like, yeah. Are you going to get rid of the bike? I'm like, okay. Because he had so many friends that died on motorcycles.
Oh, damn.
And so he was like, very like, you got to get rid of the bike. I'm like,
fair enough.
All right, Dad. Anyway, I still have a dirt bike though, so I go dirt biking from time to time.
Yeah, it's a lot safer. It's fun and like forces you to be present. The only thing you don't want to do is like you don't want to be a hero. Like always be present. Yeah. And,
Stay on the back roads and take it easy and
take it easy and like you can't weave. If the traffic is moving faster than 30, 35, you don't weave. That's like the biggest. Anyway,
I used to weave in Seattle. I remember I was working at Boeing, which is on the opposite side of the town of Seattle.
Yeah.
And I would weave like all the way. I could get, you know, it could be an hour of traffic.
Yeah.
An hour of traffic in a car and it'd be like 30 minutes on a bike.
Yeah.
So I'd ride my bike as much as possible. But in Seattle, it rains a lot anyway. What is the biggest challenge in leading a startup?
Growth for me right now, like growing fast enough. Like I need to get, like, I still think like an engineer. So I need to find creative ways and talk to creative people to see what can we do to grow faster. That's the biggest challenge that I'm facing actively.
Yeah. It seems to me that you could actually build in a viral loop with that freemium model that you're toying with.
Yep.
So that's maybe there's some low volume people, kind of like the MailChimp strategy, right? I used to work at Vertical Response, which competed with MailChimp.
Yeah.
And they were eating our lunch and I ran growth marketing. I ran growth at Vertical Response, an email marketing company.
Yeah.
And I remember just MailChimp just killing us with their freemium, because the freemium is like, that's 80% of the market. 80% of people don't actually need or want to pay for your product, but they'll use it from time to time. And through the viral loop mechanics of like powered by MailChimp, they were acquiring lots of users. And so they were just growing so much faster than us.
Yeah. So MailChimp's freemium model worked because they had a really strong word of mouth factor associated with it. They were also very early.
Oh, yeah. Get on MailChimp. It's free.
Yep.
If you have under 500 contacts.
Yep. Yeah. And small businesses, which is their target, like BSBs actually, sub 10, that's where they started. They like small business speak among themselves like quite heavily.
Yeah.
So that became a really good beachhead for them. We tested that. It doesn't work well for us. So we're trying to like do other different ways, like providing technical SEO and stuff like that on the pages, video pages themselves. So I need to like get creative, talk to other growth folks who have done this before and like, see what can be introduced here, because we thought it worked for Loom. So we thought it would work for us, but it didn't.
Yeah.
So
we have some sales consultants on Team Ignite that basically help you stand up that kind of sales process, like who to hire, how do you set this up, how do you book the demos, how do you send out the quote, like just for, and I've watched these guys take he's been on the podcast actually, Gonzalo, like episode 4 I think was one of my first guests, but I've watched him take multiple startups from call it 100k 200k and just like 5 or 10x that revenue very quickly.
Nice. Please do connect me with him.
yeah remind me. He's in the partner list.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a good guy. A technology trend you're skeptical about?
Skeptical or scared? I can't be skeptical anymore because I used to be like, hey, agents, not possible, but it's like all the skepticism is out of the window. As for me right now, anything is possible. The biggest skepticism I have is with quantum computing. People think it's really, really far away from it actually being commercially viable. And the commercial applications will also be very different than what we see now. So right now, people only think about cryptography. Yeah, it's going to spawn new industries, but it's still like a couple decades away. That's the biggest area of skepticism I have.
It's not following a price performance curve like Moore's Law, where you're getting twice as many qubits per dollar spent.
$1 million
or something like that.
Nope. The research is very, very nascent. Very, very nascent.
Mm.
There might be some applications, but the catch point to there is you won't fund the research heavily unless you see the commercial applications of this. And right now, outside of cryptography, there are very few. Like, people can't imagine like what's possible with this.
Yeah.
Just like if you didn't give people internet, they wouldn't be able to understand like what was possible.
Yeah.
So stuff like that is just not. There's 3-4 steps ahead.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know too much about it. Last question. What's your mantra for dealing with failure?
I don't have a mantra. It's like, fail, sure, cool. Like, I fail it almost every day, every week. So what are you going to learn? And then move on.
Yeah, I love that.
There's one thing my dad told me when I left in my native language. So I'll translate it to English. He told me, no complaints, no excuses when I left my city. So that's, I guess that's my like mantra for failure. Like, sure, like you do everything you can. If you fail, fine. No complaints, no excuses. Move on to the next one.
I love that. Yeah. You put your best into it. You're going to fail a lot. If you're not failing, you're probably, one of my favorite is when I fail, and I fail a lot, and I have a lot, is like, well, if I wasn't failing, I wouldn't be trying hard enough or trying new things.
Yeah.
And so you're testing the things, you have to be failing in order to be learning and growing.
Right. Yes.
And so if everything's just gravy and everything's just working well, like you're probably not doing anything exemplary.
Yeah.
Anything that pushes the boundaries.
Yep. Yep. I hear you.
Well, Kanad, thank you so much for coming on the program. I'm sure would-be founders and potential customers and hopefully some VCs will find this episode enlightening. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Brian. It was really fun chatting with you. And obviously, we'll chat again as well. I'd love talking to you.
Yeah, likewise.